Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles published in December of 2024 by the Geographic Society. I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article, Why We Sing Auld Lang Syne on New Year's Eve. The iconic song became a staple at the stroke of midnight with a little help from 18th century poet Robert Burns and the Scottish diaspora. If New Year's Eve had an official carol, it would easily be Auld Lang Syne. Every year, just after the clock strikes midnight, people around the world join hands and sing this beloved song. Why is Auld Lang Syne a New Year's tradition? From its beginnings as an 18th century Scottish poem to its iconic status today, Auld Lang Syne captures the spirit of the holiday. A Scottish poem. The song was actually a poem penned by Robert Burns in 1788. Traditionally considered Scotland's national poet, Burns stirred the country's national consciousness by writing in the dying-out Scots language. In English, Auld Lang Syne roughly means times long past. Fittingly, the song tells of old friends meeting after time apart. Although Burns's version is the one that we know today, there were earlier versions of the poem, including Alan Ramsay's from 1724. Burns explained his version was indeed inspired by another, as he claimed to music publisher George Thompson in September 1793. Quote, "I took it down from an old man's singing." Burns was not satisfied with his version of the poem's original tune, dismissing it as mediocre. So between 1799 and 1801, Thompson found and fine-tuned a different melody for the song. It's the one we still sing today. A Song for the Year's End. Burns's song soon found a home in an annual Scottish tradition, Hogmanay. A blend of Norse and Gaelic customs, the holiday celebrates the last day of the year. For centuries, Hogmanay, not Christmas, reigned as the biggest winter holiday in Scotland. After all, the Church of Scotland, the country's official church, had banned the celebration of Christmas in 1640, since it felt the holiday was not Protestant enough. Unable to make merry at Christmas time, people embraced Hogmanay instead. During Hogmanay, Scottish women, men, and children exchanged gifts and visited friends and neighbors to welcome the new year. Another Hogmanay tradition, singing. Some songs, such as A Gid New Year's to Nae, were widely recognized. Others were created by families or local communities. With its emphasis on friendship, reminiscence, and parting, Burns's Auld Lang Syne expressed the essence of Hogmanay, bidding adieu to one year so another could begin. A New Year's Tradition. As Scots people immigrated in the 19th century, they brought their Hogmanay traditions with them around the world, including Auld Lang Syne. The song soon became a fixture in New Year's Eve celebrations in the United States. Jazz band Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians played it during a New Year's Eve radio broadcast in 1929. It was a hit, and Auld Lang Syne remained a midnight staple of the band's annual New Year's Eve show, which aired on radio and eventually television every year until 1976. The show's success popularized Auld Lang Syne as a quintessential New Year's song across the country. As Life reported in December 17, 1965, should Lombardo and his Royal Canadians fail to play Auld Lang Syne at midnight on New Year's Eve, a deep uneasiness would run through a large segment of the American populace, a conviction that, despite the evidence on every calendar, the new year had not really arrived. However, musicologist M. J. Grant emphasizes in her book, Auld Lang Syne, A Song and Its Culture, that at the time the song was already firmly established in many communities, quite possibly beginning in the Scottish diaspora. So the tradition of playing Auld Lang Syne on New Year's may have not started with Lombardo, but his band ushered in a new beginning for a song that honors the past while welcoming the dawn of a new day. That's the end of the article, Why We Sing Auld Lang Syne on New Year's Eve, and there was no author cited for the article. In keeping with some of the celebrations of the New Year's, whale watching on New Year's, these are some of the most unique celebrations across the Americas. These New Year's revelers celebrate the holiday a bit differently, from a sardine drop at midnight to lively street parades. Again, no author was cited for this article. Junkanoo, a polychromatic burst of music, dance, storytelling, and parades practiced in the Bahamas, was recently inscribed on the 2023 UNESCO representative list of the Intangible Cultural Heritage of Humanity. It's the first intangible, a practice, skill, tradition, or craft, in the island nation recognized by the International Cultural Organization. A Bahamian New Year tradition since the 18th century, Junkanoo revolves around pulsing street parades, enlivened by cowbells, whistles, horns, and goatskin drums. Many participants don bold outfits created in communal studios called shacks, where elders teach youths costume design, an experience considered a rite of passage. Parades are held annually on Boxing Day and New Year's Day throughout the Bahamas, with the largest parade in Nassau, the capital city. Junkanoo is among many unique New Year's events across the Americas, from sinking sardines in Maine to illuminating fireworks shows in Aruba. Here are four ways to celebrate the start of 2025, besides watching a ball drop in New York City's Times Square. Aruba, Klapchi viewings. In Aruba, vivid pyrotechnic shows called Klapchi light the skies on New Year's Eve. Many times neighbors will join forces to create one massive display, says Emily Garcia, spokesperson for Aruba Tourism Authority. Tourists aren't allowed to set off fireworks at their hotels, but they can see memorable Klapchi events at several resorts, including the Ritz-Carlton Aruba, Renaissance Wind Creek Aruba Resort, and Aruba Marriott Resort and Stellaris Casino. Oregon whale watching. Gray whales, which migrate along the Oregon coast from mid-December to mid-January, create a symbolic spectacle representing the cyclical nature of life and renewal, says Allison Keeney, Travel Oregon Communications Manager. From December 27th until January 1st, volunteers staff 15 coastal locations to help visitors see the thousands of gray whales cruising south to warmer Mexican waters. Prime spots include Nikahani Mountain Overlook, Cape Miras Lighthouse, Boiler Bay State Scenic Viewpoint, Cape Foulweather, Umpqua Lighthouse, and the Whale Watching Center at Depot Bay. Volunteers point out whales between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m., explaining their migration and offering stickers and educational pamphlets. Visitors can also book a trip with Whale's Tail Charters, Dockside Charters, and Tradewind Charters to get a closer glimpse of the creatures. Maine, Great Sardine Drop. At midnight each New Year's Eve, New York City drops a ball in Times Square, and Key West lowers a conch shell amid revelers near the water in Florida. But in tiny Eastport, Maine, an 8-foot-long illuminated sardine descends into the main square for revelers to kiss as the clock strikes 12. Fireworks and brass band music add to the spectacle for attendees, many of whom wear homemade sardine-shaped hats. The event pays tribute to Eastport's rich fishing heritage. In the early 1900s, the island town near the Canadian border held 18 canneries. Eastport became known as the sardine capital of the world, says Hugh French, director of the Tides Institute and Museum of Art. Today, visitors can explore shops and galleries in the historic downtown or book windjammer cruises from the Eastport docks. Missouri, La Guignolée. Missouri's oldest town, St. Genevieve, was established in the 1730s by French settlers. Now their descendants celebrate this heritage each December 31st with La Guignolée, an ancient French New Year's wassailing or caroling custom, says Geoff Gogliano, director of the French Colonial American Museum in St. Genevieve. Troops of costumed singers, dancers, and fiddlers perform in and around the 18th and 19th century buildings in this historic town, an hour's drive south of St. Louis. These shows and their use of the local Paw-Paw French dialect are proud vestiges of a distinctive culture created by previous settlers. The continuing survival of French Creole stories, traditions, and architecture in St. Genevieve gives the town its unique character and appeal, Gugliarano says. And that's the end of the article. The title was Whale Watching on New Year's. These are the most unique celebrations across America. The author, Ronan O'Connell, is an Australian journalist and photographer who shuttles between Ireland, Thailand, and Western Australia. This article's title is What Are Stars Made Of? A century ago, this woman found out and changed physics forever. Humans have observed the stars for millennia, ever since our ancestors looked toward the sky. Throughout our history, the sparkling patterns of light upon the inky black sky have acted as compasses and calendars, told stories of gods and goddesses, and inspired poets and artists. But humanity's relationship with the stars changed dramatically in 1925, when a young graduate student figured out what the twinkly lights were made of and laid the foundation of stellar astrophysics. This intuitive and brilliant astronomer was Cecilia Payne, and at 24 years old, she showed that stars were not like our Earth, but instead were growing spheres of mostly fiery hydrogen and helium, the two lightest and simplest elements in the universe. It is such a fundamental piece of understanding for humanity, says Anna Friebel, an astrophysicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But like many hypotheses or discoveries that counter the leading theories of the time, Payne's thesis was questioned and argued. The fact that she was a young female astronomer pushing against the status quo at a time when all academic experts in astronomy were men, heightened tensions. Today, Payne's graduate thesis remains a staple on the bookshelves of stellar astrophysicists. It's more than 200 pages yellowed from age and use. Today's scientists see it as a masterpiece of astronomical writing, of putting the pieces together. It was attention to detail, says University of Wyoming stellar astrophysicist Meredith Joyce, of Payne's thesis. It was accurate, and it was really brave. Investigating the stars above. In the early 1600s, humans began building and using telescopes. Observers realized just how prevalent stars are in the night sky, and that they clump in cloud-like nebulas. In the early 1800s, observers first used prisms to spread incoming sunlight into a rainbow of colors. Later that century, astronomers determined that by placing a prism between a telescope's lens and a detector, they could record starlight. The prism broke apart the incoming starlight, which rained onto a photographic glass plate coated in an emulsion. As the photons of light interacted with that emulsion, it created a dark mark. Upon that plate lay a fanned-out pattern of dark regions and empty spaces, each marking a specific color of light, the signature of a faraway star. By the mid-1800s, researchers found that light from heated gaseous elements in laboratories produced opposite spectral patterns, mostly empty regions separated by bright lines of color. Physicists realized they could use those bright lines to interpret that gas's chemistry. The materials in Earth's crust, scientists found, showed similar patterns to those seen in the stars. And so astronomers thought that the sun and all the stars were made of the same stuff as Earth. We had no real reason to believe that anything in the universe was different than what we could observe on Earth, says Joyce. Who was Cecilia Payne? Cecilia Payne's light came into existence May 10, 1900, in the English town of Wendover. According to her autobiography, while in her teens, she studied science and music before earning a scholarship to attend Newnham College at the University of Cambridge in 1919. Payne initially studied botany, but switched to physics within her first year. She learned about atomic physics from Ernest Rutherford, the man who discovered that every atom had a positively charged core called a nucleus, and Niels Bohr, who studied how electrons behave surrounding that positive nucleus. Late that year, Payne, by chance, attended a lecture at Trinity College by Arthur Eddington, where he announced the results of his expedition during the total solar eclipse of 1919. He captured images of stars' positions, which appeared to shift due to the sun's pulling on their starlight, altering the light's pathways. During that lecture, Eddington confirmed Albert Einstein's brand new general theory of relativity, and Payne fell in love with astronomy. In 1923, she sailed to America to begin her graduate studies at Harvard College Observatory and Radcliffe College in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She got herself to the only place that women could succeed in astronomy, says Tom Burns, the observatory's curator of astronomical photographs. When Payne joined the observatory, all astronomers and students were men. Some 10 to 20 women also worked at the observatory, but they were the, quote, computers, a term used for lab assistants who performed calculations. In this case, the women looked for patterns in the starlight and recorded changes to the visible stars. Payne, under a graduate fellowship, had a different role from the other women. Her mentor, Harlow Shapley, initially urged Payne to continue the work of a computer, Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who had realized that variations in some stars' light could be used to measure distances. But Payne wasn't interested in Leavitt's project. Instead, she wanted to focus on the decades of mostly untouched spectroscopy plates, says Burns. No institution had more of these emulsion plates preserving star signatures than Harvard. Another computer, Annie Jump Cannon, had started to classify stars based on their signatures. Payne wanted to build on this work, combining what she learned about the inner workings of atoms at Nauheim with the recent scientific theories of physics and chemistry to understand stars. The physics of the stars. Physics research was accelerating at the time, and the discoveries in scientific theories were traveling across the globe. Researchers had figured out the source of the patterns on spectroscopy plates, electrons shifting energy levels as they zipped around an atom's nucleus, an action that emits or absorbs light. The color of that light was specific to a particular atom, meaning an electron in a carbon atom would always absorb or emit the same amount of light to reach a zippier state or drop back to a relaxed one. Within a few years, experiments determined most of energies that kick electrons to different levels for many of the atomic elements. By looking at these characteristic lines in the starlight spectra, scientists could see the missing colors or empty spaces on the plates matched perfectly with atomic elements. They could now identify the constituent elements. The stars in the sky showed blank spaces where their gas absorbed the energy streaming from the nuclear furnace burning at their cores. Most of these lab studies looked at neutral elements. Stars are giant balls of super-hot, pressurized gas, and no one had yet figured out how those extremes might change the light patterns of different elements. Payne combined the current understandings of atomic physics with a brilliant idea from Indian physicist Magnad Saha. She wrote in her autobiography, Saha had just determined how gas behaves in differing temperatures and densities, and specifically how the contained electrons move in extreme environments. Based on the high temperatures and pressures of stars, Payne calculated the strengths of the starlight spectral lines in the Harvard plates. The different lines always had a certain strength relation to each other, says Friebel. From that, Payne could calculate the abundance of the elements in the stars. Payne's work showed hydrogen and helium, the two lightest chemical elements, are incredibly abundant in stars, while heavier elements are much less prevalent. She also described what creates the observed shapes of the lines, how the interior pressure and temperature of the gaseous material affects the light signature. Understanding those shapes, says Iowa State University stellar astrophysicist Stephen Kowaler, is essential for using them, the spectra, to understand the dynamics of the atmospheres. Payne used the absorption lines not just for abundance or temperatures, he adds, but to understand what's physically happening within stars. Stars are everything. Payne completed her thesis in 1925, and with it she earned her doctoral degree in astronomy from Radcliffe. Initially, her contemporaries were skeptical. Renowned Princeton astronomer Henry Norris Russell, one of the leading stellar astronomers of all time, was one of her loudest critics. As a nod to his concerns, she wrote of hydrogen and helium, "The enormous abundance derived from those elements in the stellar atmosphere is almost certainly not real." While the rest of the text oozes confidence, says Kawaller, this statement was a temporary diffusion of an otherwise very exciting result. Just 4 years later, however, Russell confirmed Payne's findings. This work gave us the starting point of understanding what is measured in stellar spectroscopy, says Friebel, who uses starlight to search for the oldest stars. Payne's discoveries have helped future researchers piece together what is occurring below a star's surface over its lifetime, how energy produced at the center of stars moves through their outer layers, and how stars die in explosive blasts, or instead feebly fade into the inky black backdrop. Stars are everything, says Joyce. Everything else we know about the universe comes from stars. That's the end of the article. The title was, "What Are Stars Made Of?" A century ago, this woman found out and changed physics forever. And that ends the program for today. I hope you enjoyed it. This has been the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. The articles I've read were published in December of 2024 by the Geographic Society. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, and then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.